This is Scott Becker. I'm thrilled today to be joined on the Becker's Healthcare Podcast by Dr. Ken Candido. Ken is one of the great physicians of our time. He's a great thinker, a great speaker. Ken, we're thrilled to have you with us today. Can you take a moment and introduce yourself? Then we'll ask you about COVID-19, what you're seeing when we get back to new normal, what that looks like, and also some of your thoughts on opioid-sparing efforts, where I know you've spent a lot of time and thought. Dr. Candido?
Thank you, Scott, and it's a privilege to participate in one of your several venues. I'm always thrilled and honored to come into this world-class organization, and what you produce is really unrivaled in the world of medicine. So I am Ken Candido, and I'm a chairman of a department of anesthesiology in Chicago at the Advocate Illinois Masonic Medical Center. I'm also clinical professor of both surgery as well as anesthesiology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine. So I wear an academic hat, I wear a clinical hat, and as you aptly pointed out, but we're very generous, of course, I love to teach, I love to lecture, I love to be involved in the education of up-and-coming physicians. That's really what I aspire to do, is to impart some of my knowledge and wisdom and hopefully create a better world with the future leaders in medicine going forward.
Well, thank you. You do a great job of it. You know, we're all in this period of this crisis, this pandemic, this COVID-19, and there is so much news on it that it's very hard to sort through. Are we all going to die? Is it going to be okay? What's the rhythm between the two of those? Can you take a moment and tell us what you're seeing? What are you seeing out there?
I love the intro because I did read something that you posted on one of the social media forums earlier where you said, just tell me what you're reading or watching and listening to, and I'll tell you what your viewpoint is. And it's absolutely true. If you're quoting something in the New York Times, it'll be disparate from what you see in the Post or perhaps in Fox News, for example. And I'm seeing a lot of uncertainty. And the question is, what's going to happen? And this is an unprecedented event in all of our lives. I talk to people who are octogenarians and people who've survived World War II, and nobody can conjure up a remote memory of anything, at least in recent times, which even comes close to the apocalyptic lifestyle that we're all kind of confronted with. Social distancing, all the new terminology, PPE, personal protective equipment, social distancing, how we maintain things change our entire lives. And Tony Fauci said, we'll never shake hands again. Well, never shake hands. What about the handshake deal? What about high fives? Are high fives also off limits now for the rest of all time? So we're dealing with a lot of confusion. The people that I work with, I run a large anesthesiology group of 18 practitioners and 32 residents and 6 nurse anesthetists. They're scared to death for their own lives as well as for the lives of our respective patients. And I've never seen people fearful of anything. This is really an unprecedented time, but yet and still, it's a wartime situation, but unlike what we've historically been confronted with in real wars, this is an invisible and very feisty foe that can jump from person to person, stays on your shoes, stays on countertops, lingers in the air. Nobody knows for how long or under what pretext one might be exposed to this. I just read a story today about a perfectly isolated lady who got COVID-19. All she did was open the door and take a package of food coming into her from one of the delivery services. And did it stay on the bag? Was it in the plastic? Nobody knows. And it's the unknown, which is extraordinarily fearful, fear engendering in clinicians, Scott, because physicians like science. We like to know things that are black and white. Cut and dried. This is a disease. This is how we address it. This is how we solve it. This is unlike all of that. We don't really know what we're dealing with. We don't really know how to resolve it. Does hydroxychloroquine and Z-Pak and zinc somehow make this mystically and mysteriously disappear? Is it going to cause arrhythmias in a certain degree, a certain percentage of patients? How is it preventative? How do we prophylax against this? Is a vaccine in the imminent future? Is it 2 years away or 4 years away? I just don't have a clear appreciation for what's happening. And the news media, of course, are portraying each and every day we sit and we're on the edge of our seats as new data comes forth. And, you know, New York is leading the pack with 180,000 cases. New Jersey's got 60,000 cases. Illinois, the sixth largest state, but we're only the eighth largest represented. Does that mean that we enacted our social distancing in a more effective manner than some of the other places? I mean, this is the thing that is perpetuating and permeating our entire existence.
Let me ask you a question on that, because what happens is it's taking up all of our existence, it's permeating everything, you know, and people are dying. So I hate to say, is there any warning that will come out of this? Is there any positive that will come out of this? Is there any silver lining? Or is it such a mess that it's hard to see that?
So that's a fantastic question. I think that what Tony Fauci stated very simplistically, that the handshake is essentially dead. All of our medical interactions will have to be revamped. My pain clinic, for example, I was seeing several hundred patients each week. It'll never be the same. I won't be able to interact face-to-face with patients without an N95 mask or a face shield and gloves. And the days of coming into and greeting patients and giving a warm handshake, sometimes a hug, those days are long gone. Now my patients are going to be screened at the door with temperature assessment for cough and sore throat, and they'll have to wear their own masks. So the new normalcy, there is no new normalcy. I think that for the foreseeable future, possibly forever, to be ever more distinct from what we grew up knowing, what we did ourselves as patients, what we did as physicians with our patients. We will never interact in a manner with other humans, at least in the medical sense, the way we did before January of 2020. And it's astounding to me. I mean, the impact of it reverberates and can't even be comprehended at this point.
In terms of those changes in practice, in that physician-patient relationship, will that return, though, to some kind of new normal? You're a thinker. Any thoughts on how that might look like over time?
Well, I think there may be some beneficial outcomes to it, Scott. I mean, if you think about, let's say, influenza, and I don't want to confuse COVID-19, of course, with influenza, and I wouldn't do that, and I'm not an epidemiologist anyway or an infectious disease expert, but think about all the deaths from influenza that we never really got our arms around and said, how are we going to mitigate all the losses of life and all the people getting infected? And we had flu shots, and perhaps they were 30% effective, and we had herd immunity and all these terms that we now have become household names. I think what we're going to do with some of this alteration in our business practices and our face-to-face interactions with patients, we may see a massive improvement in the common cold or in the flu, things that we took for granted as just being part of the cost of doing business with our patients and our clients. We may see a massive reduction because of some of these tools that we're implementing now to keep ourselves safe from their air and themselves safe from our air. So there may be some very positive outcomes that come from this that are unanticipated. And I'm only seeing, being an optimistic person as I am, I'm thinking to myself, some of these other coronaviruses and some of the things that the common cold has been linked to have a remedy or cure for that, maybe keeping ourselves away from other people a little bit. And I'm not talking about our loved ones. I'm not talking about in our day-to-day interactions with people, but the people who are sick, who come to the hospitals, who perhaps are carrying, are harbingers of some of these infectious agents and some of these viral entities, which we never got our hands or wrapped our head around until now. There may be a substantial change in the way we see these types of things evolving as time elapses. So I'm an optimistic person. I'm actually thinking that there may be some benefits that come from these types of distancing procedures.
Right. Your point is well taken, that if we start to wear, if we're still a little more careful on all these things all year round or through flu season, I mean, the flu a couple years ago killed 70,000 people in our country. Pneumonia deaths are always very high, that maybe we'll cut some of those too, just through some of these efforts that we're doing, social distancing and so forth. Are we going to be wearing masks forever now? What's your sense of that? I mean, I know, you know, we've always, there's a stereotype, you would say in the airport, people from Asia wearing masks, you know, it's been much more prevalent on that side of the world. Is that something we're going to see here in much greater numbers to protect us all and to avoid our ear infecting others. What's your sense of it? How long does that last? Is that going to be a forever thing till there's vaccines things? What's your sense of it?
I think, and I'll share my own personal experience. I do a lot of speaking across the globe. And in 2016, I was in Hong Kong. And I remember as I was walking the streets and taking mass transit, seeing about 75% of the individuals there with face masks and chuckling to myself, and as the arrogance of the Americanism will tend to make us do, right? And I said, wow, these people are really clueless. Well, no, they're not clueless. I was clueless. I really anticipate going forward that that there's going to be a change and an alteration in how we perceive ourselves and those around us. And whether it's, as I stated with, as Tony Fauci said, no more handshakes, no more high fives. I think people are going to be wearing masks for quite some time. Do I think it's going to be forever? I don't know the answer to that, Scott. I would have to say that I would say it's going to be at least for people who are reading all of this information and taking it all in, it's going to be for more than a year. I know for myself, it's going to be quite a while. I've got probably four or five masks in my automobile. I've got one in my trunk and three on the front seat just in case I've got to exit the vehicle to run into a store for something. It's unprecedented. I have hand sanitizer in my car. I've got gloves, rubber gloves in my car. I mean, this is the new norm.
And let me ask you another question. PPE and testing. You know, there's this wide swath of criticism. We don't have enough testing. It comes from the right or the left. There's also a wide swath of criticism on PPE. Can you do me a favor and help me cut through a little bit of this on why is the testing so challenging to make happen for 330 million people? I mean, the more one studies it, the more one understands that this is a process. But can you shed some light on that?
That's a great question. Obviously, even in my own practice, where I employ about 60 physicians and nurses who work under my stead, I've kind of gone to the administration almost on a regular daily basis and kind of implored them that I'd love to have everyone in my practice tested. We need to know who perhaps is an asymptomatic carrier. And they're just simply, they claim that there isn't the availability of tests. And yet I talk to my friends at Abbott, for example, St. Jude's, who've created the antibody test and 15-minute and 45-minute exams. And I'm scratching my head. Is it an economic issue? Is it a political issue? I agree with you wholeheartedly that we ought to have the ability to go out and test 328 million Americans. Why are we not doing it? I don't know what the answer is. I'm hearing so many different conflicting messages about where are these tests? Why can't we get everybody tested?
And Abbott, I think, said today that their ability to bring out these tests is just the rapid test. There's nowhere near their capacity to bring those out in the timing that we would like for the amount of people we'd like to test. And so what they've sort of said is that's just one piece of the testing puzzle. And then so testing, all of us are used to the flu test where we get a 5-minute result almost, and we sort of want that now, yes. But it seems like it's going to take some time. And then on PPE seems like, and we've always imported so much of it, we've bought it so much from other places. What's your sense of what it takes to ramp up production of PPE so that PPE, you know, is not nearly the amount of block or challenge or limiting step for providers that it is today? What does it take to ramp that up?
Well, so I think that if you look historically where we've obtained a substantial amount of our PPE, it's been from China. And now, whether it's due to our reluctance to confront that relationship or the fear of whether we're getting legitimate PPE from them, I think that is there an element of panic in doing and negotiating business arrangements with China? We have obviously have our own companies, 3M and all the companies that can make PPE. We've got people with 3D printers who can actually create their own PPE. I don't know what happened, except the only explanation that I can come to is that it's like toilet paper. People are hoarding it and not sharing. And I've seen that in my own institution. I've seen people taking boxes of masks and putting them under, sequestering them under their coats or putting them in briefcases. And I've stopped people at the door leaving and saying, wait, those masks are intended for all of us. So I think that there's an element of that where the fear factor has caused panic and has led to individuals who are sequestering some of this for the hopes that they'll use it for themselves and their family. I don't know what's happening to the PPE. certainly there was never an issue before this all evolved. And I think that it's going to loosen up a little bit as the numbers start to decline and we actually hit these peaks and people start to get a little bit more comfortable. Look, I've been using the same N95 mask. Maybe I shouldn't say it, but I've been using the same, being very, very careful with it. And I haven't gone out and been throwing it away, but I think that there's been an element of that as well, where some people will not reutilize a mask and will not reutilize. I just wash everything off. I wash my gloves continually. I wash my mask. I let it air dry. I'm taking as many precautions as I can. And maybe it's suboptimal, but I think that part of it's got the mass production of a lot of these PPEs have come from overseas, and I think that there's a reluctance and people are taking a hard look at whether or not we ought to be producing them ourselves. But we certainly have the ability to do that. It's the greatest country in the world. We can make masks. We can make gloves. Where are they?
Yeah, and it's sort of really ramping that up so that as we get further into this, we've got them for our healthcare providers to begin with and everybody else. Another question for you, and you're a sports fan by nature. I know that in addition to being a brilliant leader and you're one of the nation's leaders on opioid sparing, will people start to decorate their masks with their sport logos and stuff like that? Is that something you're going to see?
Absolutely. We're going to see all kinds of aberrations and we're going to see all kinds of PPE being decorated with little messages to loved ones and their favorite artists and sports teams. It's inevitable. That's what we've always had. I actually saw somebody with a MAGA mask. Now, I don't want to get into that all that, but I'm seeing people now who are starting to politicize what they're putting on their faces as advertisements. There's no question that we're going to see an explosion of that once people get a little bit more comfortable. The fear factor right now, Scott, is what's driving all the decision making. But I can anticipate that when things loosen up a little bit, people have a tendency to want to be happy and want to make other people smile. That's human nature. I think we're going to get a lot of that through our PPEs.
Well, let's hope so. And another question for you, and just a moment on this. It's not the topic of the day, but I'd love to get you on another time to talk about this. Opioid sparing efforts. How did you become such a leader in that movement? And take one moment on that and how people learn more about you as it relates to opioid sparing.
Thank you, Scott. Well, obviously, for the longest time, we've had an epidemic. You know, an epidemic is a term broadly used. It's any problem that's grown out of control. So an epidemic is an outbreak of a disease. It occurs over a wide geographic area. Now we're with a pandemic, which is a geographic spread to describe a disease that affects the whole country, the entire world. But the opioid epidemic was something I always had a fascination with. I've always had an interest in managing chronic pain conditions. And of course, opium and morphine have a very long and storied history. But I got a little bit agitated when we started to throw around terms like the opioid epidemic, because I've been doing this for 35 years, managing chronic pain. And I've always known that Americans have had a love affair with opioids. And I said, wait a minute, stop here. This is not a new phenomenon. It is not the coronavirus or COVID-19. This is something that's been lingering for not just decades, but for a few centuries. And I wanted to put it in the perspective for the public so they didn't want to just jump on the bandwagon and start pointing fingers at Big Pharma. Yes, they've made mistakes and there's been some cruel and evil practices on their behalf or on physicians. Yes, some physicians are cruel and have made mistakes and deserve to be punished for that, or on the patients themselves. But I wanted to actually conceptualize for the American people what is the reality of the opioid epidemic. I do produce the talks. You were very gracious and generous and allowed me to do that at one of your meetings, and I hope I'll be invited back again. But I think people need to be educated about the history, because after all, as George Santayana said, those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it. And I'm trying to get the message out there about the opioid epidemic and put it into a historical perspective so we don't repeat those mistakes again.
Well, fascinating, and thank you. Dr. Candido, it's always a pleasure to visit with you, one of the most articulate, bright people that I know. I appreciate you joining us so much. We'll have you on again in not too long, we hope. Thank you so much, sir.
Scott, my privilege. Please stay safe. Thanks to all your listeners, and thanks for having me. I'm truly grateful to you.